Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Kathleen Guzman is yet another creative woman with a long list of credits to her name. The second licensed woman auctioneer in the United States and possibly the world, Kathleen is the managing director of Manhattan's Heritage Auctions, the third largest auction house in the world. She has more than 40 years' experience in the art and antique industry. Check out these stats. Kathleen has auctioned more than 1,500 sales, a million-plus objects valued at more than $1 billion. The ruby slippers from the Wizard of Oz movie, they went for $660,000. A Monet watercolor, $4.3 million, to name just two. Kathleen's expertise is much in demand. She's appeared on the PBS series Antiques Roadshow, also is a host on QVC, Oprah, Good Morning America, Today, CNN, as well as online publications. She lectures extensively about the art market for various organizations. Before joining Heritage, Kathleen was president of Christie's East and president of Phillips Auctioneers, as well as senior vice president of business development at eBay. She was also director of the Hubert Gallery, specializing in works by Henri Matisse and Pablo Picasso. Kathleen, welcome, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Sandy. Great to be here.
Growing up, how important was art in your life?
Zero. Art was zero in my life. I did not have an art epiphany until college. My parents were not collectors. I did not grow up in a house that appreciated art. When I went to college in New York City, one of my courses was art history, and it was a teacher who was so charismatic, so handsome, that even at 8 o'clock in the morning, the entire class of women had full makeup and looked gorgeous.
And there was no way you were cutting that class, in other words.
I was smitten. I was just enthralled by how someone could be so excited about things that were so beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I simply made up my mind that is what I was going to do. It was not what I went to college for.
What did you go to college for?
I went to college to be a fashion designer, especially costumes for theater. And I just found that I was just not that creative.
But you were attracted to creativity. It's not like you went to college to get a degree in accounting.
That's very true. I was always flirting with that field in some way. But I do feel that for me, and for a lot of women, that luck plays a big part in how your career develops. I simply fell into most of the jobs that I had out of luck, being in the right place at the right time. My very first job at an auction house was a cashier. And very honestly, I couldn't balance a checkbook. But I thought, this is the kind of place I want to be for the rest of my life.
An entree into.
And no matter how, what level I had to start, whether it was sweeping with a broom or cleaning bathrooms, I was going to be in that environment and I was going to work my way up.
But this seminal moment for you with this course and this professor led you to take obviously more classes and then to go on for a master's degree.
Yes, vanity led me through to my art history degree.
Why do you say vanity?
Because honestly, I think he was the hook. He was a sexy guy teaching sexy material.
Did you ever tell him?
Oh my gosh, yes.
You did?
Oh, yes.
Did you let him know what an impact he had on your life?
Yes, and he was very grateful.
I guess you don't tire of hearing those things.
No, especially if you're a man, I'm sure. But.
That's a whole other show, isn't it? That's a whole other conversation. So you get your master's. And was your first job seriously in the art world being a cashier at an auction house?
Yes, it was. I worked for a small auction house. It was called Plaza Art Galleries.
In New York City?
In New York City. They were at the time the oldest auction house in New York. They since folded because a lot of the small auction houses really couldn't keep up with the industry. But it gave me my start. I was able to learn the material, learn how to auction. Learn how to, it's a very apprenticeship feudalistic business. Huh. Regardless of how much schooling you have in art history, if you want to work with objects, there's no better teacher than being with objects.
So hands-on.
Absolutely.
And were you mentored there?
It is hard to say that. It's more indoctrination by fire.
Okay.
Yes, I had very good male colleagues who helped me. I wish I could say in my 40-year career I had very good female mentors, but frankly, I did not. I never did. I always found I was in competition with other women.
Yeah, that's what's always so hard. Yeah.
But I had very loving teachers, and I absorbed as much as I could from them. So after being at Plaza for 4.5 years and they going into receivership and folding, I got my job at Christie's as head of the Art Nouveau Art Deco department, which is somehow named today 20th Century Design. And was that an area that I had an expertise in? No, it wasn't. But it was an opening, mm-hmm. and I talked my way into it. And it was a marvelous opportunity to learn a new area that I got to be an expert in and rise up in my career at Christie's.
So clearly you were a sponge.
I guess that's what you could call me, yes.
Mm-hmm. And as you were making your way, did you see some sort of goal? You were aspiring to what? Become an auctioneer, which would be fascinating considering you had no role models, female role models.
Well, it's a funny thing how I became an auctioneer. You know, Christie's and Sotheby's are 18th century companies mm-hmm. that are very male, were, especially when I was there, very male dominated. And there were no women auctioneers.
Right.
I mean, they, you know, the auctioneer is the figurehead. How can a woman be there? It's like the Catholic Church nominating female priests. You know, it just wasn't.
Yeah, we're just not done. So move on.
Done.
Don't whine about it and just it is what it is.
So there was a very charismatic woman at Sotheby's, my counterpart company, mm-hmm. who ran their Asian department. And Lorna Kelly was demanded that she could have a better presence if she was an auctioneer. And she really pushed her way into doing it by saying, you know, I will leave this company if you don't give me this opportunity. So needless to say, in 1978, she got a huge amount of accolades for being the very first woman licensed auctioneer in New York City. And so when I joined Christie's, they said, oh my gosh, we really need a woman auctioneer. They get all this publicity. So, you know, rather than looking from within and having a rigorous school, they said, well, Kathleen has a big mouth. Let her do it.
And so is that a steel hand and a velvet glove in a way in terms of a compliment?
You know what? I'll take anything I can get to get myself to the next rung. You know, I didn't view myself as a trailblazer. I simply viewed myself as being in the right place at the right time.
Is that what you aspired to? Is that what you thought this is the next step on the ladder for me, is to be an auctioneer?
That's a very good question. I think I always aspired to being part of the establishment of the corporation, of being a senior vice president and part of the executive committee. Through being at an auction house, I realized that the figurehead was not the president of the company. The figurehead was the auctioneer.
But what do you mean by figurehead? Because sometimes they don't do anything.
An auctioneer is the emblem of the culmination of putting together that entire sale, the disposition of the wealth for it, mm-hmm. and they stand up there and they're the spokesman for the company for that day. And it's a very, very important role. Even if you were not a good auctioneer, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Being an auctioneer was well regarded in an auction company. And so that was something that I aspired to sort of in just the whole panoply of what I was going to do in within that company.
So did they groom you for this?
I was a little appalled when I became an auctioneer because
appalled?
Basically it was just stand up there and do it. And so within the time that I was at Christie's, I actually started the auctioneer school because I felt auctioneering was, you know, the most important role that you could have at the time. And you know, rather than having someone just stand up there and do it, that it was very important. So I brought in speech coaches and hairstylists and clothing people to work with the individual candidates who would eventually be auctioneers for the company, so that we could put our best foot forward in a very pivotal role. In, you know, a good auctioneer is a great host or hostess. Mm-hmm. They make you feel comfortable spending money, but not, you know, sloppy drunk where you like putting cigarette holes in sofas. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just sort of a fine line. You know, you have to be the master of ceremonies without being the devil incarnate. That's a skill that's learned. It's not a skill that people have innately.
I was just going to ask you, is that, so that's something that's taught?
Yes. And funny enough, in the auction school, I found that sometimes the most introverted people were the best auctioneers. And sometimes the most gregarious people were the worst auctioneers.
Well, does that stand to reason that it's about the object, it's not about you?
It's about stealing thunder away from the process when you become too much of a star.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's a fine balance, I think, to be a really good auctioneer. And I'm proud of not only that I was able to do that for this wonderful company, but that I have so many students all over who became great auctioneers, who are either still at Christie's or have gravitated to other auction houses or have started their own business. This is a very small niche. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. Everyone sort of knows everyone. And there's less than 7 degrees of separation in the art business. Mm-hmm. And I'm just proud to be able to have been a mentor, not just in auctioneering, but in my corporate roles. I have certainly really made an effort to try to have a camaraderie in a very competitive environment. And, you know, for people whose compensation is based on what they bring in, very often, you know, it's like herding cats. you know, it's very hard to get people to work together. But yet, I think what I do the best is I knit people together who have very strong opinions, but find that they can share with each other and be more productive.
I want you to go back and tell me, what was it like when you called your first auction?
Oh, my gosh. So my very first auction, we had these auction stools that were very high. So your feet dangled. You didn't stand. You mm-hmm. sat. Mm-hmm. And after auctioneering, I was very nervous. I remember feeling nervous, but I got off the stool, which was quite high, and I fainted dead out on the floor. So I thought I had done such a good job, but yet, you know, in the front, you know, I was splayed out on the floor.
That's so hilarious. Sorry, but that's pretty funny.
But it was memorable, and I knew from that day on that was my chosen field.
So is it often that someone who is an auctioneer that is combined with being an appraiser? Not that they're one and the same, but they go hand in hand?
Most auction houses need the experts to be the art appraisers. They generate the business because they have the relationships with the clients, they know the value of the items, and they know the clients who want to buy them. So that's a, you know, a three punch. Being an auctioneer is great because those clients feel that that's very important. But in terms of compensation levels, an auctioneer doesn't make any more or less because you're really based on, you know, like just like business, you're based on what you bring in.
But what's that like for you to still be an anomaly in this field?
I think what's so interesting to me and my 40-year span of being an auctioneer now is how the landscape has changed in buying art. So, you know, when I was an auctioneer to start out with, there was no internet. People rarely bid on the phone because phones weren't reliable. They left, and if they could not come to an auction was really a participation sport, They left what was called a written bid that the auction house executed. But no one really trusted order bids. You know, if you left a bid of $10,000 and you got it for $10,000, the client would always question, was there really somebody bidding underneath? Did you really? So there was a lot of mistrust in the auction business, per se. And so as an auctioneer, it was a little bit more colorful time for me because I would get all of these crazy notes from people. If my glasses are off my face, I'm bidding. If my glasses are back on, I've stopped. You know, if my finger is on my nose, I'm bidding. If it's not, you know, it was really, it was like, you know, there was a point where I'd have so many notes, it'd be like, just bid already. You know, I can't tell what you're doing. You know,
it's like being a spy.
You know, it might have been the smallest silver auction that I was taking, and there still could easily have been 100 people in the room. So fast forward to today, where I'm not selling $100,000 auctions of silver. I'm selling, you know, $5 million auctions of comic books.
Wow.
And how many people are in the room? 3, 10. Not many, but yet with proprietary systems like at Heritage, we have HA.com, which is our own proprietary bidding site. I can see how many people are in the lobby waiting to bid on that object. I took an animation sale recently, and although we had 30 people in the room, I had 634 people in the lobby waiting to bid on that lot. Then there's other online interfaces that most auction houses use, so Live Auctioneers, Artsy, you know, other bid platforms. Plus, we take a lot of phone bids, and we have people who are leaving bids because now there's been a sea change. If you deal with an auction house that you trust, you're going to leave a bid and not feel that you're being bid up. One of the categories that we sell, don't laugh, is the luxury accessories, which is just another word for expensive handbags.
Okay.
We've sold an Hermes bag for over $200,000.
Wow.
So we had this man who was a very good, loyal client of Heritage, and he wanted to buy a gift for his wife for Christmas, but he couldn't be online. He couldn't bid on the phone. So the estimate on this Hermes Birkin was, I don't know, $8,000 to $12,000, something like that. He left a bid of $60,000.
Oh my, it was five
times more than the bag was worth in retail.
So did it, I mean...
And he got it for, I think, $9,500. And it just as an example of how now we're in a different time. If they trust you as a company, they're going to believe that you're going to do the best for them. Buyer and seller. I am going to do absolutely the best for the person who gives me that consignment. I'm going to try to get them the highest prices, but I'm not going to do it by bilking a person who has left an egregious bid.
Yeah.
You know, there has to be a balance in the marketplace. And it's shifted because of social media, because of the internet.
And more people have more money these days.
Well, certainly, you know, whether you're a fan of Trump or not, he certainly loosened pocket strings. People in the past, I would say 6 to 9 months, are spending more money. And they're...
Why? Because of him?
I think there was a reticence before about what direction we were going in. You know, there's always a pullback. There's always a slowdown before a new president or a new change because people don't know what direction they're going to go in.
Right. What to expect.
But, you know, the stock market went up.
Right.
Went up and people felt good about spending money.
As versus 2008, which must have been a bad year for
you. It was very bad. Heritage was a great company while other auction houses laid people off because they couldn't get their revenue projections. We didn't lay one person off. We didn't give raises that year, but we didn't lay anyone off. You know, I'm very pro working for a company that is that really values their individuals. And when I first working for Christie's, they were a very small you know, they were an 18th century company in the U.S., in the U.K., but they had just come over to the United States when I had started working there. So we were, you know, a small patriarchal organization that really cared about its employees. And as time went on, you know, they became much more commercial, much more driven towards profits, much less for the under guy. And you know, that all makes sense. They're a big company. Mm-hmm, they have to, you know, look at the bottom line. And I'm not saying that we at Heritage don't look at the bottom line. We do. I just feel like we're a more paternalistic organization.
There's a humanity.
And I like that. For instance, I live in the only building on the Upper East Side that was vacated during Hurricane Sandy. And I had no place to live. And my company put me up in a hotel for 2 weeks. And I don't know anybody else who would do that. Why would they do that? Because they know that they can make more productive employees when your employees are happy.
Are happy. Talk to me about some of the objects that you've auctioned off that have had a, you know, a real impact for you.
Well, I have to say that it's all about stories, which is what the Antiques Roadshow is all about for me. And, you know, I have auctioned million-dollar objects, and that's wonderful. But the things that I remember most are the pieces where I really helped somebody. There was a gentleman who worked on the movie Casablanca, and he got an Academy Award, an Oscar, for being the screenwriter. He had a house in Woodstock. It was his only asset, and he was dying. And he asked, could I auction it? And this was back in the time when you can only sell an Oscar if it's prior to 1950, because after that, the Academy got smart and they make you sign a waiver that you have, if you want to sell it, you have to sell it back to a dollar. But this was, you know, 1941, so it was early, so he was able to sell it.
And he needed it to survive.
And he needed it to survive. And we sold it. I put an estimate of $80,000 to $120,000 on it.
And what year was this?
Oh, goodness, 84.
Okay.
And it brought $250,000. And he was thrilled. He brought his children and his grandchildren. They all sat in the room. He cried. That, to me, is a wonderful experience to make a difference in someone's life.
But is it with mixed feelings that this object, even though it brought so much money, has a lot of meaning?
It
or maybe not. Or maybe I'm projecting onto
that. No, it had a lot of meaning to him. And I see where you're coming from, but I'm in the business of selling stuff. So I believe there's a circle of life.
sure.
And that, you know, it's just cyclical. Stuff stays in the market and it changes hands from one happy place to another. I mean, sometimes they're greedy places, sometimes they're, you know, but, you know, basically, you know, those things that are important in our history change hands. And so one of the, you know, people always ask me, what's the most expensive thing you've ever seen at Antiques Roadshow? Most expensive thing I ever saw, I didn't even get on with, because the producers didn't think the story was
worth it. But
I remember the great-grandson of a woman called Virginia O'Hanlon came in. He lived in Phoenix, and he brought her scrapbook. And in 1894, Virginia was 8 years old, and she asked her father, was there a Santa Claus? And being a great parent like he was, he said, well, honey, you should really write to the newspaper, because if they say there's a Santa Claus, there must be a Santa Claus. I love that part of it. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a parent. You don't want to give bad news to your kids.
Of course.
So this man was really creative. So Virginia writes this letter to Frederick Church of the New York Sun asking, is there a Santa Claus? And Frederick Church then writes this editorial, which is reprinted even today, that every Christmas that begins, yes, Virginia there is a Santa Claus.
Right.
And it's all about belief in God and fairies. And it's a wonderful elegy of life. And this great-grandson brought in the original letter that Virginia wrote when she was 8 years old.
Holy cow.
How do you value something like
that?
Yeah,
really, really.
And I feel that, especially for Antiques Roadshow, I feel that I hand down oral history. These are things that don't go in books. these are things that people hear. Yes, Virginia is there. Well, I don't know what that means, you
mm-hmm,
know?
Mm-hmm.
But yet, it's integral to our American fabric of life, these kinds of moments. And so, you know, again, it was very hard to value. You know, Virginia really was a stay-at-home mom. They wheeled her out every Christmas. She did a high. You know, she went back to baking. And but what I remember is this great-grandson had such reverence for this woman who passed away.
Mm.
It gives me the shakes today to think about it. You know, we banner the word priceless all the time. You know, what is priceless? Everything really does have a price.
Yes.
But if you could ever use the word priceless, it would be on an object like this. And the family really had no interest in selling it. They wanted to keep it. It's very personal. And so I put an estimate of $30,000 to $50,000 based on, you know, other sort of comparable diaries that have come up on the secondary market. So the best part of the story is the family contacted me and asked, could I help them make a donation appraisal? And so now the letter is actually at the Yale Library, where it is open to the public and can be seen.
Oh, how fabulous.
And can be enjoyed.
How fabulous.
And I think that's the important part about what we do that can make a difference. I mean, sometimes it's just not monetary.
Why do really famous people sell things? Like, I read that you worked on Marilyn Monroe's estate and sold some things that belonged to Barbara Streisand. Why do they do that?
It's really a very interesting phenomenon. I don't often know the reason. When I met Anna Strasberg, who was the executrix for the Marilyn Monroe estate, Marilyn died intestate without a will. And so since she didn't have any family, everything went to Lee Strasberg, her acting coach. And Lee didn't know what to do with it, so he just took everything in the Beverly Hills house and put it in storage. And then Lee passed away. And Anna's dream was always to have a museum. It's hard to have a museum. You need a lot of money to have a museum. So we started going down that path of trying to find sponsors and appraising the collection. And it was pretty clear that it was worth way too much to hold on to.
Mm-hmm.
And that sale brought about $8 million.
No kidding.
And the highlight was the dress that she sang Happy Birthday, Mr. President.
Oh, to JFK?
Yeah, which brought over $1 million. And it was the first piece of costume that had ever brought that amount of money. So for that situation, it was simply a decision based on the fact that things were rotting in Manhattan mini storage.
Mm.
And they needed a home. Miss Streisand was a fantastic opportunity to work with a really creative woman. At the time, she was doing her major concert series, and she was donating her homes to the Nature Conservancy. She had a place in Malibu that had 5 or 6 different houses. She took great care to have each of the homes decorated in a certain way. So one was arts and crafts, one was Art Nouveau, one was Art Deco. She had just meticulous taste and was a wonderful person to work with. She had a vision, but part of that vision was, you know, she needed to make this donation in order to, you know, maximize the potential of what she was doing with the concert. And the Nature Conservancy got a fabulous gift, and we at Christie's got a great opportunity to sell all of these beautiful arts and crafts, all these different homes. So there's all kinds of motivation as to why a celebrity would decide to do something. But there are always personal reasons. And I honestly, maybe I'm just being small-minded here, but most of them are not egotistical reasons.
Oh, that's really interesting that there's another dynamic connected to that. How many auctions would you say you call in a year?
Oh, goodness. Less than I used to. Well, probably commercial auctions, about 30 a year. But I am also a charity auctioneer.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm in a wonderful place. I can give back.
Mm-hmm.
So I donate my services to nonprofits to do charity auctions. So I do as many as I can, usually about 20 or 30 a year.
So you got a lot on your plate, don't you, Kathleen?
I feel blessed.
But you love what you do.
I love what I do. You know, I'm 62 years old. I've been in this business for 40 years. My husband keeps on telling me when I'm going to retire. And I'm like, why?
Yeah. Why should you retire?
I do what I love. I wake up every day happy and excited to go to work. How many people at any age can say that?
Yeah, that's for damn sure. When you say something like that and then you look back where you were with this hot professor back in college who turned you on. What do you think as you go over those 40 years in your head? I'm sure it's not done on a regular basis, but you know what I mean? That who would have thunk back then, right? Look where you are.
I certainly wouldn't have thunk it. I do not have a high IQ.
Well, what does that mean? I mean, be a scientist? Who cares?
You know, I got B's, not A's.
Yeah, so?
I was the kind of student who, if it was assigned, I would be working the entire semester on it.
Mm-hmm.
I was married to a gentleman who was so smart that if he was assigned something, he would do it the night before, and he'd get an A and I'd get a B. I just was like the little engine that could. I just tried harder. And
you believed in you, didn't you?
I did.
That's a big thing.
I think I've evolved into the person that I have become.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember at the very beginning, I was so, it was so difficult to be at a reception or an art gallery opening because I had such a fear of meeting people. And
that they would think you were a phony?
I just was very introverted. I was supposed to be a social worker or, you know,
or a teacher.
Or a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And if I look back at anything, I marvel at how I now talk to everybody. I will meet the cab driver. I will talk to the policeman. I will meet someone next to me. Like yesterday, I was getting a manicure who happens to have an art collection. Who is this person?
Yeah.
It was certainly not me 40 years ago, but yet I love everything about what I do, and I'm grateful every day I'm here.
Isn't that fabulous? Do you ever look back and think, in a sense, that you were a trailblazer?
No, never. No.
In spite of the fact that you could say you were just in such a minority as a female auctioneer.
I think I've heard it said from a lot of women who are in positions of authority, they didn't get there because they believed they were the token woman. They got there because they tried harder. And I feel like I tried very hard. I mean, but Christie saw something in me that at the time I didn't. They sent me back to Columbia for my MBA. Why would they do that if they didn't feel that I had
the potential? Don't suffer fools gladly, for sure. What an empowering conversation. And how great that not only that you do what you do, but you love what you do. It's contagious. I can't thank you enough for coming here and sharing your story with me and having this terrific conversation.
Well, Sandy, it's not good enough unless I find out what you collect and help you collect it better.
You don't want to know. Trust me. Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.